Welcome to Arrivée by the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lloyds. Lloyds is a partner of British Cycling and so sponsors the Great Britain team in this year's World Championships. After Zoe Baxter's win in the under-23 time trial earlier in the week, Team GB added another gold medal and rainbow jersey when Harry Hudson won the men's junior road race. Hudson became the first British rider to win the men's junior road race at the Worlds, following in the wheel tracks of some of the sport's greatest riders, Greg LeMond, Mathieu van der Poel and Remco Evenepoel among them. Hudson won the race in Kigali with a sensational 35km solo attack, and as he lifted his arms to celebrate when he crossed the line, you may have seen the famous Lloyds horse logo on the chest of his Team GB jersey. His Great Britain teammates Max Hines and Matthew Peace were 4th and 5th, making it 3 riders in the top 5. Lloyds is supporting British cycling from grassroots level right up to riders who are representing the country against the best in the world, and the junior worlds are a huge step on the ladder towards reaching the pinnacle of the sport. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now let's get on with the show.
You're listening to Arrivée by the Cycling Podcast.
Lionel Burney, good evening.
Good evening, Daniel.
Good afternoon. It's an early finish, isn't it? Early finish for the World Championships. Quite convenient for what's to come on this Sporting Sunday. But Lionel, we have seen what some might describe as a bit of an action replay of last year. An extraordinary second consecutive world title for Tadej Pogacar, which felt a bit less extraordinary than last year's, because although it was a bit of a carbon copy, Tadej Pogacar is normalising, or has normalised, the extraordinary.
Yes, it was not as impressive as last year, but it was nevertheless very impressive. It was decisive, it was clinical, and Tadej Pogacar keeps the rainbow jersey for another 12 months. I feel sorry for anyone who tuned in with sort of 60k to go, thinking, oh, I'll sit down Sunday afternoon and I'll watch the important bit of the World Championship road race. It had all happened by that stage, really, and it was kind of, I was going to say a slow march to the podium, but it wasn't a slow march to the podium. It was a fast march to the podium and a sort out of the order of the 3 medals. But really, the gaps were just kind of opening and opening. And, well, we can get into the historical context of, you know, what the results tell us about today's race. But another Tadej Pogacar kind of masterclass. He created the blueprint, or he certainly had a hand in creating this blueprint, and he executed it very well.
Lionel, I think you said slightly less impressive than last year. What you meant by that was that it seemed more routine, because it was actually a better performance than last year. It was better managed than last year, in the sense that there wasn't those sort of 15 minutes or whatever it was last year, half an hour probably, of kind of squeaky bum time when he was clearly struggling and the gap was coming down. There wasn't any of that this year, was there? And also, tactically, it was more straightforward, wasn't it? Because last year we had the moment when he bridged, thanks to great work by Jan Trantnik, he bridged to a group that had gone down the road earlier on and then launched another attack and went solo. Today, none of that was needed, was it? We said in the podcast earlier this week that it was possibly going to be a very untactical World Championships. It was interesting, over the last few days I've seen on social media people disagreeing with that, saying, I saw one tweet yesterday saying, I don't see how Pogacar can win this Worlds, because he's just going to, well, the same thing that happened in the women's race is going to happen in the men's race. They're all going to watch each other, all of the top favourites. But it did end up just being a sort of a watts test over 6 hours, didn't it? I described it before we started recording, it's a bit of a Gran Fondo.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, really, because it was just let them all out of the starting pen, and then fastest to the finish gets the gold medal and the rainbow jersey. And it's interesting, that context, isn't it? Because last year it was a real kind of jaw on the floor performance for a world championship. This year there probably was elements of it where he was much more in control of what he was doing, And as a result, it looked a bit less spectacular. As you say, it looked a bit more routine. I mean, there was a whole phase where he was holding off a chase group of five riders and the time gap really wasn't changing for the best part of a couple of laps. We'll get into that in a bit. But it was him just holding everybody else off at sort of arm's length and then multiple arm's length, really.
Lionel, without too much further ado, because we've delivered the main headline and the winner of the 2025 Men's World Road Race, the gentleman who will wear the rainbow jersey for the next 12 months, as he's worn them for the last 12 months. Shall we tell the listeners, anyone who, Lionel, as you suggested, will tuned in for the last 60 kilometres and didn't see a whole lot, should we tell them what they missed? Do you want to kick us off, Lionel, by telling us what happened in the early phases of the race?
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it? There was plenty to enjoy in those first, 4 hours of racing. The first significant break of the race went clear with Menno Huising of the Netherlands, Ivo Oliveira of Portugal, Marius Meyerhofer of Germany, Anders Foldager of Denmark and Fabio Christen of Switzerland. They got away, and then the French rider Julien Bernard, he rode his way across the gap, did so in pretty short order actually. Around this phase of the race, there was a very curious move by Julian Alaphilippe, former two-time winner of the World Championships, of course, winner in Quebec in Canada a couple of weeks ago. He made this move off the front, but then before we knew it, he'd pulled over and pulled out of the race after just a couple of laps, 37 kilometres, I think it was. Also in this phase, Raul Garcia Piena of Spain, he took a lot longer to ride across the gap than Julien Bernard did. It took him about 20 kilometres, and that made our breakaway group of seven at the head of the race. A significant crash in that early phase brought down Ilan Van Wilder of Belgium, a key support rider for Remco Evenepoel, of course. Marc Soler of Spain, Bjorn Kurt of Great Britain as well was one of the fallers. All three of those riders had to pull out. The big crowd in Rwanda were delighted by a couple of attacks off the front of the peloton by Eric Manizabayo. He went clear and held off the peloton for a while, and when he got caught, he went clear again. That leading group of seven, though, didn't get any more than 3:15, in large part because Slovenia was kind of watching the front of the peloton. Belgium were kind of in amongst them as well, making sure that the gap didn't get out of hand, because there was some good riders in that break.
Mexico also contributing, or certainly a bit later on, Mexico contributed one rider to the pace setting.
They did. And in that first phase of the race, the kind of first 100 kilometres, the other drama was Tadej Pogacar's visit to the toilet, which led to a chase.
It's a very lavatorial World Championship, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it? Yeah, there was actually a camera right next to the portaloos, and I was half expecting Rob Hatch and the commentary team to start assessing kind of pit stop strategies. Remco Evenepoel dashed in at one point, didn't he? Didn't appear to lock the door. Did he wash his hands? Did he get his bib shorts all the way
enough
off?
Already.
I don't know.
Enough already.
You don't like this kind of stuff, so let's move on.
Yes. Well, Remco was going to have a very dramatic day, wasn't it? It was sort of not the Count of Monte Cristo, but the Count of Mount Kigali. Lots of up and downs. I think he was sort of compensating for the early abandonment of Marc Soler, left a sort of drama shortfall in this World Championships, and Remco made up for it. Lionel, did you just kind of take us to the point at which they went off the main circuit and towards, well, the middle segment of the race, which was the decisive segment? We debated this, didn't we, in the podcast at the earlier in the week, whether it was a little bit too early. Obviously, Mount Kigali, which was the biggest climb, a real sort of almost a proper mountain climb, 6 kilometres, about 20 minutes. And then there was going to be the Mur de Kigali, the Kigali Wall afterwards. And we sort of deliberated, didn't we, whether this was too early for Pogacar, particularly bearing in mind what almost befell him last year, when I think probably had a bit of remorse last year about having gone quite as early as he did. Probably if you'd asked him before this World Championships was kind of unveiled, the course, where would be the ideal point for the kind of decisive climb to be, he might have said 60 kilometres or 70 kilometres, but he didn't want to do 100 again. But anyway, We did see, well, we saw Slovenia, didn't we, moving to the front. That moment where he'd had to chase back and Mohoric had helped pace him back. He seemed to be okay. There were some fears that he might have some kind of stomach issue, as Alaphilippe you mentioned, and there were other riders who had stomach issues. But he looked okay, and the Slovenian riders were at the front of the bunch, the Belgians as well. We've mentioned the Mexicans. And then on to Mount Kigali, and well, what happened?
Well, yeah, we were well over the halfway mark by this point, and the bunch had been whittled down, probably only about 80-90 riders left in it at this stage of the race. I felt a bit for Meyerhofer, the German rider who was in the break, because at this point he was the only German rider left. The rest of the team had all pulled out, and the bunch was whittling down. The break itself was splitting as well. There was Fordager, Bernard and Oliveira were the three that stayed out in front, but all of the focus was on the front of what remained of the peloton. And we saw Tadej Pogacar accelerate, marked very smartly by Juan Ayuso of Spain and Remco Evenepoel of Belgium. But then all of a sudden, Evenepoel was in difficulty and couldn't hold the wheel and was drifting back through the next group. Then Del Toro of Mexico rode across the gap to Pogacar and Ayuso, and we had my fantasy scenario of three trade teammates up the road. All of them, of course, ride for UAE Team Emirates. Ayuso, of course, leaving for Lidl Trek. I thought maybe there's going to be a bit of kitchen sink drama here, but by the time they got onto the Muir de Kigali, Ayuso couldn't hold the wheel either, and that left Pogacar and Del Toro
for a minute. It looked
together.
As though they'd never ridden a bike with gears before. for a minute, it was he was definitely spinning a very very small gear. I don't know whether he had an issue at that point, but it looked sort of comical. He was obviously in this small ring and in a pretty big sprocket, and he was going all over the place, wasn't he, on the cobbles. Just looked as though it was the first time he'd ridden on cobbles. Like I said, I think it was a combination of him maybe having mechanical issues and also not having the legs to follow at that point. But he sort of vaporized at that point from the race, didn't he?
Yeah, you mentioned mechanical problems. I mean, Remco Evenepoel was going through a world of pain, wasn't he, with his saddle position. He was banging the saddle on his first bike, then he stopped, swapped bikes, got onto the replacement bike, and then he was unhappy with the saddle position of that one as well, and he pulled over again and let one support vehicle go by before he could get his gold bike replacement. Didn't look terribly happy, stood by the side of the road. And while all that was going on for Remco Evenepoel, Pogacar and Del Toro were riding pretty well together. There was a big group behind. It was 34 riders at that point. The Italians were well represented with four riders. The Australians had four riders. The Belgians had three. Evenepoel among them, of course. And I think the warning signs for everybody was that as the time gap went up to sort of the 45, 50-ish seconds mark for Pogacar and Del Toro, the chase was really starting to wipe riders out, wasn't it? The Australians went to the front. Jay Vine and Michael Matthews were then basically dropped and out of the picture, one after the other. And it started to look like there wasn't going to be enough cohesion in that chase group to bring the leading duo back together. But then on that cobble climb, when they got back onto the circuit, 77 kilometers to go, that was when we saw Del Toro beginning to struggle. He couldn't hold the wheel. Pogacar kind of did the half turn and looked round, slowed down and waited for him.
Yeah, it was interesting because maybe on the previous time up that same climb on the cobbles when Ayuso was dropped, in fact, for a moment it did look as though Del Toro was maybe gapping Pogacar, but I just saw that Pogacar was struggling a little bit to hold the wheel, and my head at that point was kind of filled with, well, obviously all of the hype that had been created by, I think it was those four one-day Italian classics wins that Del Toro has had recently, and you started to think of, well, what if this does turn out to be a sort of changing of the guard? But that was a very sort of fleeting moment, and it turned out to be a bit of a mirage.
Yeah, it did, and I think it was the distance that had done for him, because all of those four one-day races in Italy that he's won in quick succession over the past two, 3 weeks are in the sort of 195 kilometer mark, and by this stage we were over 200 kilometers and a significant amount of climbing.
Pogacar also mentioned that Del Toro had stomach problems. That's certainly what Del Toro told Pogacar at that point in the race. And we saw a Shimano neutral service car come alongside them, didn't we? And it looked as though they were going to get something, whatever it was he needed, to maybe help Del Toro. But I remember Pogacar kind of shooed the car away, sort of suggesting that whatever it was he needed, they didn't have it.
Yeah, and Del Toro sort of hung in for about 10 kilometers until they got back on one of those climbs, and Pogacar then rode clear on his own. By this stage, the chase was kind of breaking up. Initially, there was Mikel Honoré of Denmark, Pavel Sivakov of France, and Ben Healy in a little counter move, but then that was caught, and we had a real power quintet, didn't we, of Remco Evenepoel, Tom Pidcock, Jai Hindley, Ben Healy, and Matthias Kjellmoser. And those five, I mean, that looked like a decent bet to at least contain Pogacar's advantage. But for sort of three laps, the gap stayed at around a minute to a minute and 7-8 seconds. Pogacar was riding on his own. The five behind were riding, cooperating well, but they were not bringing that gap down. And then all of a sudden, it was down to just three riders, Remco Evenepoel, Kjellmoser and Ben Healy. And that really was the final sort of three laps, wasn't it? It was just everyone riding in their positions.
Remco doing the bulk of the work and looking the strongest until, well, he decided that they were holding him back effectively, and he did attack, didn't he, and got away.
Yeah, that's one of my big questions I'll ask you a little bit later. But yeah, 20k to go, Remco attacked the other two, set off in pursuit of Pogacar. Didn't close the gap at all, but he did secure the silver medal. And then on the last lap, inside the final 10 kilometres, really, Ben Healy eased away from Kjellmoser to take the bronze medal for Ireland. First Irish medalist in the men's World Championship road race since Sean Kelly in 1989. But back-to-back rainbow jerseys for Pogacar, back-to-back Tour World Championship doubles for Pogacar. Impressive.
Shall we give the top 10, Lionel? Pogacar wins time 6 hours, 21 minutes, 20 seconds. So that's an average speed of 42 kilometres an hour, just over 42 kilometres an hour. Of course, what did we say in the end? Over 6,000 metres of climbing, 6,080-something metres of climbing, I think, in the end. Or 6,096, sorry. Second, Remco Evenepoel, 1 minute, 28 seconds down. Third, Ben Healy, 2:16. Kjellmoser in fourth, 2:53 down. Then a huge gap to Tom Skuins, who was fifth, 6:41 behind Pogacar. Ciccone, who we barely saw all day, but he finished sixth, 6:47 down. Del Toro on the same time. Ayuso on the same time in eighth. And incidentally, that was the equal biggest group that we saw finish. I picked this out yesterday, in fact, of all of the road races we'd seen so far. The biggest group, I think, was seven riders, and that was in the men's junior road race. Small groups throughout all of the races. So that was Ayuso in eighth. Ninth was a really good ride by Afonso Eulalio of Portugal, 7:06 down, and Pidcock was 10th, 9:05. Incidentally, Roglic was 11th. He finished with Pidcock. And I would just also pick out Lionel Paul Sixas, the best French rider, and turned 19 a couple of days ago, didn't he? He was 9:47 down, which sounds a lot, but he was pretty strong, pretty deep into the race, wasn't he? He was one of the stronger looking chasers for a lot of the time that Pogacar was away. 30 finishes, we think, in total. Linus, that was, is it eight more than Duitama? We talked about Duitama in Colombia.
Duitama was 20 finishes, but yeah, 20? the smallest number of finishes in a men's road race at the world since 1995. 30th place was Emmanuel Gebrezabia of Eritrea at 12 minutes and 4 down, and the only finisher from an African nation, but did well to, you know, kind of finish on the same lap, really. I mean, it was basically just down to anyone that finished on the same lap as Pogacar in the end, wasn't it?
Lionel, should we hear from Pogacar himself? Here he was after his second consecutive world road race title.
I think the parcours was designed for this, but I was hoping that a small group would form like we did with Juan and Del Toro. Perfect combo. I was like, okay, this is like dreams, not to ride together as far as possible as a trio. But Juan had a problem quite soon on the more of on the cobbles, and Del Toro had some stomach problems, I think, after the race. I mean, in the race, so I was left alone quite early, and I was all over like last year, just fighting with myself. But I'm so happy I made it.
What are there moments where you doubted?
For sure, yeah, because the climbs were getting harder and harder every lap. And also on the downhills was not so fast. You still had to like pedal quite a lot. So yeah, the energy resources was going towards the end, and it was so hard. The few final laps, and of course you doubt a bit, but you have to push through and hope for the best.
To do it here in Africa, to do it on this course, under 30 riders finished, makes it even more special.
Yeah, no, it was an incredible experience altogether, and let's say it was a successful week.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel. Babbel is a language learning app which has revolutionized the way you can learn another language, transforming the whole experience into an enjoyable and engaging one. And you can make real progress very quickly, fitting the short bite-sized lessons into your daily routine. And with just 10 or 15 minutes a day on the Babbel app, you can begin to put into place the building blocks for another language. And before you know it, understand and speak that language really well enough at least to enjoy a trip abroad. Perhaps you are looking at going to one of the Grand Tours next season and you want to learn a bit of Italian, French or Spanish before you go. Well, if you get started with Babbel today, you could make some significant progress before next summer. And right now, Babbel is offering all listeners to the Cycling Podcast up to 60% off a subscription. Go to babbel.com/cycle to claim your discount. That's babbel.com/cycle, and you'll get up to 60% off a subscription. That offer is valid for a limited time only. Get started with Babbel today. Flexible lessons to learn a new language with voice recognition software that also helps you to develop your pronunciation and avoid a tap on the shoulder from the pronunciation police. So go to babbel.com/cycle for up to 60% off today.
Well, Lionel, we are not alone in sort of scrambling now for superlatives to describe Tadej Pogacar's performances, because he himself now seems to struggle for sort of words, adjectives to kind of contextualise what he's doing. I mean, I'll just sort of go back to what we started the episode with, that I thought today's ride, although nominally very similar to last year's, it showed all of the sort of learnings of last year as well. And I think it highlighted, and you know, as watching spectators, I think we've all sort of taken this on board as well, that one of the, particularly when we talk about teammates in races like this, maybe the key contribution that teammates make in a race like this now is to do with sort of feeding and fueling, because I think that was absolutely, well, that was certainly key for Pogacar in making sure that what nearly happened last year didn't happen today. And I think, you know, without going into too much detail about the lavatorial element to this World Championships, I mean, I think if we speak to riders, and maybe in the podcast later, we'll maybe get Larry on later in the week to talk about the World Championships, with all we'd heard about air quality, with all we'd heard about altitude, but also just the distance and the meters of climbing, the heat as well, humidity, I think we'll probably find out that that was very much at the forefront of all of the riders' minds, and particularly Pogacar's today.
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, these events now, you know, we know what is possible because Pogacar has made it possible. Not the only one, of course, going from a long, long way out in big one-day races. But I suppose the difference between last year and this year was that there really wasn't any sense of jeopardy, even though the time gap was holding at that consistent 1 minute, 1 minute seven. It didn't feel like he was suddenly going to struggle. I was thinking back to Amstel Gold in the spring when it looked like, you know, he was setting himself up for the treble, and he did recover to win Flèche-Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, of course, but he was away, wasn't he? And it sort of all melted away for him on that occasion. I didn't get the sense today that there was any danger of that really happening, even though, you know, a minute, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that that group of five could have nibbled into it. But I think that was the most interesting thing about that phase of the race, which was the fact that they had a group of five world-class riders and they just were not making inroads into that advantage. And I think if Remco Evenepoel had maybe gone a lap earlier, he potentially might have begun to chip away at it a bit more, but I think it was telling that he didn't go that lap earlier, because that would have been the point that he would need to go to chisel away enough of the time to put a seed of doubt in Pogacar's mind and maybe start to give the sense that he was catching. But the fact that he left it till 20 kilometers to go, there or thereabouts, said to me that he was just trying to get the best result he possibly could today, which was a silver medal. And there was a sense that, yeah, it was a race for second place, really, from quite a long way out.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we will revisit Remco and his race, his very dramatic race in a minute. But I, in the preview episode earlier in the week, we were sort of talking about the course and what did it sort of look like, what did it remind us of, although it had this billing as the hardest world championship ever. And we talked about it being kind of similar in some respects to Amstel Gold, with the exception, or you had to sort of bracket almost that middle section of the race with Mount Kigali, which was a different kind of climb, much longer. But I don't think it's any coincidence necessarily that the four riders that finished behind, or sorry, three riders that finished behind Pogacar, were the three riders who in recent Amstel Golds have given him, well, something to think about. So obviously Skelmoser beat him this year, and that was a group with Remco. And then when Pogacar won Amstel Gold a couple of years ago, it was Ben Healy who was the best of the rest. So, I think it, of all of the sort of classics that we see, that was probably the one that it did resemble the most.
I'd agree with that. The third of 30-odd climbs, but without the technical aspect.
Exactly.
So it made it a much smoother ride. There was a bit less of kind of the stop-start accelerations, a bit less fighting for position. The roads were quite nice and wide. The cobbles didn't look too severe, but certainly added a little bit of an element. But as a race, was it the hardest of all time? I mean, 30 finishes in this day and age, I think you have to say that does put it up there with Duitama in 1995, the other super hard edition of the last 50 years, Sallanches in 1980, which Bernardino won. And that was when there were only 15 finishes and 10th place was Giovanni Battaglin at 8 minutes 34. I mean, the time gaps were bigger than that to Tom Pidcock in 10th place today, 9 minutes and 5. I mean, the sort of time gaps that you might see in a week-long stage
grand
race.
Tour. Well, no,
or
Grand Tour.
Or Grand Tour even, yeah, and yeah. 9 minutes spreading across the top 10. And the fact that the field, although it wasn't 165 riders deep in terms of, World Tour riders, certainly, the 30 that finished, there's not a weak rider among them. The depth of that top 30 is pretty significant, and I think it was telling really that that there were only 30 finishes. It was obviously hard from early on, and the fact that they broke out from the rhythm of those laps and then did the harder effort, the longer effort of Mount Kigali, and then the short steep sort of kicker of the Mur de Kigali as well, before then settling back into the rhythm of the circuit again, it was interesting. It probably made it harder than the race actually needed to be. Having said that, it had to be in the race just for the spectacle, the atmosphere. The crowds on Mount Kigali itself were immense. I've been wondering all week where the sort of Tour de Rwanda style crowds that we've seen a lot of footage of over the years, where were they? Well, they were out in force today. I mean, it made it a real world championship spectacle. But in terms of the race, it was kind of the sledgehammer to beat all sledgehammers, really, wasn't it, in the middle there?
Yeah, it'd be interesting. It will be interesting in the next couple of days to talk to people who were there just to, I mean, maybe they've got an explanation for why the crowds were concentrated. The biggest crowds were on the sort of flatter sections on the way into Mount Kigali, which was obviously, I mean, the whole circuit was broadly, it was pretty close to kind of this, what I can, from what I can tell, is the sort of centre of the city, but why there in particular? But, you know, I think we saw there was a moment where I think it was Jan Christen and Mauro Schmidt, two Swiss riders, they were at the back of the peloton, kind of just reacting to what they were hearing and what they were seeing. And I think it was Jan Christen made a gesture, a sort of take this in kind of gesture, because this is unbelievable, kind of signifying or showing, telling Mauro Schmidt that he kind of had goosebumps. And I think, again, that's something that we'll hear from a lot of the riders after the race today when we hear their interviews. Just on Remco Lineham, because I suppose if we do have a lot of question marks, because it was a kind of a race that didn't seem to leave too many question marks. It was pretty sort of straightforward, not too many kind of intricacies. I mean, it was a sort of race that, to use the kind of metaphor that I often use for San Remo, you could analyse with a telescope, not a microscope. But one thing that needs to be picked apart, and I suspect will be, certainly in the Belgian press, what happened to Remco? Because there was clearly a mechanical issue, and he was clearly upset about it, and it seemed to be the same mechanical issue on two different bikes, which seems strange, because he was kind of banging the saddle on both the gold bike and the replacement black bike thereafter. But I must admit, when I saw him getting dropped or losing wheels on Mount Kigali, there didn't look to be any sort of mechanical issue at that moment. It just simply looked like he didn't have the legs. He was on a bad day. And in fact, if you'd asked me at that point whether I thought he would finish the race, I probably would have said no, because it looked as though he was on one of those days where his legs just weren't working.
Yeah, I don't want to be sort of unkind here, but the theatrics around the mechanical issues did look like the precursor to an abandonment at one point, didn't it? And you're right, he was not able to hold the wheel on Mount Kigali, and, you know, he slipped back quite alarmingly. Now, maybe that was because of the difficulty he was having with the bike at that point, but over the last third of the race, he was very strong. I'm not going to say he was perhaps as strong as Pogacar, but he was certainly stronger of that initial five rider group, and then stronger of the three when it came to the race for the silver medal. So it wasn't, it kind of salvaged a silver medal, an impressive silver medal from a far from perfect day. And when the margins are this fine, and when the riders are up against somebody of Tadej Pogacar's level, it's impossible to kind of cope with, you know any other, things going wrong, really. Having a mechanical problem, a quick bike change, and then getting back on and having no further issues might have been okay. But having recurring issues with his bikes, I mean, I don't want to hazard a guess at how much ground it cost him. But, you know, if you were to say, well, it cost him a minute and 29 seconds, he'd probably be pretty annoyed.
It was strange as well, the movement with Remco on his saddle, because usually you would expect, particularly if you're riding over cobbles, if there's anything that was going to happen to a saddle, it would be the saddle would come loose and was pointing down. But he seemed to be banging it down. Just actually, Lionel, if you can fill some airtime for 20 seconds, because I've just seen that Sportster have done a story. Because obviously we're recording almost right on the whistle today, and there is a bit of an explanation that's been given by Remco. So I'll just read that line, if you can sort of wax Bernie about apropos of nothing.
So are we suggesting that the Belgian team mechanics, I mean, who were the Belgian team mechanics? Who would they have been drafted in from? Would they have been drafted in from Soudal Quickstep sabotaging his chances of taking the rainbow jersey with him to Red Bull? No, surely not. No such things would ever happen in the history of Belgian cycling. But
Here we go, Lionel. He said, before Mount Kigali, I'd ridden into a hole, some kind of pothole. My saddle had completely collapsed. Not sure what that means. I guess it had come loose. This may sound strange, but that different position caused my hamstrings to cramp. If you're not used to that movement, it doesn't feel good. So I had to change anyway on the first time. So the first lap back on the circuit. Then on his second bike, so his black bike, I felt my saddle wasn't in the right position. It usually slopes a bit, but this one seemed perfectly level. Then I started having pain in my lower back. After that, we took my second bike off the car. But he said that then there was an issue because I think there was an issue with getting it off because a lot of riders had been dropped and they'd moved the bikes around. Something to that effect. This is Google translated, I'm afraid. But anyway, so confirmed issues with the saddle, which then led to physical issues.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly, if he's had a jolt in a hole in the road or on the cobbles, it could go one way or the other. It could tilt upwards or it could tilt downwards. So a saddle position's, I mean, especially at elite level, I mean, it's pretty critical, isn't it? So you can't ride at peak power, optimum comfort, if the saddle's not in the right position. So yeah, a sort of catalogue of unfortunate events for Evenepoel there. Certainly not suggesting any skullduggery by Soudal Quickstep mechanics. I'd just like to make that clear.
talking of skullduggery, I don't think at all that this is what happened, but Isaac Del Toro ended up doing well, and you can throw Ayuso in there if you want as well. You could almost look at that if you didn't know better, and if you didn't know that actually Ayuso is leaving the team, and that there are even rumours that his relations with Pogacar and Del Toro are not the most harmonious. You could say that those two riders conspired to give Pogacar the perfect sort of lead out or perfect kind of 20k of not being alone and completely isolated, because I mean that was the great dilemma that he did have before this race, that Mount Kigali was the obvious place to go, but I'm sure he would have thought that it was too early and that he didn't want to be alone. As I said, there's a bit of, I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before. I remember having conversations with Larry about this, and Larry's belief, Larry, incidentally, who was riding pretty well today, he was at the front going into Mount Kigali. Larry's belief is that as a career goes on, and I've heard this from other riders as well, it does become harder to go to the same places, the same sort of depths of suffering, because the body obviously remembers how painful certain experiences were. And Pogacar was fighting, he was battling that today. When, you know, before today's race, he thought about the eventuality maybe of being on his own with 100 kilometers to go. He would have had to confront the likelihood that he would feel the same kind of pain that he felt last year for the last couple of hours, last 2 or 3 hours of the race, and might have sort of reluctantly taken that on, but also might not have particularly fancied it, and would much rather have been sort of with a couple of guys at least until 60 kilometers to go. But as it happened, Ayuso didn't stick around for very long. Del Toro stuck around for a bit longer, but it kind of worked in his favor. As I say, I don't think that was some ingenious plot by UAE.
No, but I do think that Pogacar had a moment's doubt, didn't he? Because he did wait for Del Toro. He clearly didn't want to do that additional however many... Well, he wouldn't have known at that stage how long Del Toro could stay with him, but he certainly decided to ease up, see whether he, you know, trade teammates, sure, but riding for a different nation. So, but Del Toro, had he been able to, stay with him, could have been riding his way to a silver medal. I mean, still a long... This is kind of the ridiculous nature of these exploits by Pogacar. You start talking about 75 or 65 kilometres to go, the way we used to talk about 20 or 25 kilometres to go. The whole way that these races are being contested is kind of upside down. I made my sort of glib joke at the start about anyone switching on with, you know, sort of 2 hours to go had kind of missed it all, but they really had. The whole of the race had happened in those first 200 kilometres, really. And then we're in this strange place where Pogacar going through a kind of world of pain while the watching audience sort of slumbering on the sofas with snacks and drinks are becrying how kind of formulaic and simple and straightforward it looks. It's not, obviously. But the way that the races have been changed is... it has robbed that last 50 kilometres of the sort of element of drama, the sort of the ratcheting up of tension and excitement that we did have a phase of for sort of 20 years of world championship races. And you'd have good ones and bad ones. There'd be editions where, you know, a big group all came together, or it would all come together on the last half lap and you'd be left with a sense of anticlimax. This is a totally different type of anticlimax, but at least there's, you know, there are a few things to unpick here. And one of them is, I mean, you talked about the lack of sort of tactical subtlety in the race, and partly caused by the fact that the field wasn't, it was kind of a combination of not quite deep enough, but also not enough teams with enough riders, basically. I mean, I made that joke in our episode in the week about who would win the sort of evaporating prize. There are a couple of contenders, really, aren't there? I mean, Australia looked like they were in a fantastic position, and then all of a sudden they weren't, but the burden of chasing was on their shoulders.
Yeah, at least they committed, yeah.
They did commit fully, yes. And then, you know, that commitment pushed two of their key riders into the red, probably a lot quicker than they perhaps would have thought. And then Hindley got himself into that little five-man move. And then when that split down, he wasn't the right side of the split. And I think Belgium as well, you know, losing Van Wilder so early, that was a real blow for them. And Evenepoel was left really with Quinten Hermans and Utgebrooks, wasn't he? That were the last two riders with him. And so it became a race of individuals a lot sooner than we're perhaps used to seeing in the World Championships. And the one sort of tactical question over Pogacar, which, you know, became a moot point with the way that he finished it off, was, you know, did he jeopardise his chances by easing up and allowing Del Toro to stay with him for those 10 kilometres? That could have been a tactical mistake, but it actually didn't turn out that way, because then when he was alone, he was able to hold that gap at pretty much constant for, you know, a long period of time. Amazing, yeah. Really.
Yeah, and he probably had his sort of internal alarm set for 40 seconds. If the gap had gone below 40 seconds, then he would have gone. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt, Lionel, as you say, racing's changed so much, and the sort of the old dogmas, the old rules of thumb have gone out the window, whether it's, you know, the sort of 1 minute to 10 kilometers rule or various other rules. But, you know, what we don't know... We've debated it many times, but no one can provide a definitive answer as to what has changed it. There are many factors, you know, from TV coverage starting earlier to nutrition to various other things. But the sort of the empirical evidence, the result of whatever factors it is, the results are there. I mean, I think one statistic would be interesting. I've never seen a statistic to this effect, but you know, we know that races have got faster. We know the Tour de France, for example, every year is getting faster still. Pretty much every year it gets faster. And that's certainly the trend. And but it would be interesting to break that down into how much faster the hours 1, 2, and 3 have got across the season in every race, because our sort of sense and what we see, you know, in most races, and it happened today as well, the first 2 or 3 hours are a lot quicker than they used to be. We don't really get, the only times we get sort of 35 kilometer an hour first hours and second hours are those days when the peloton sort of decides en masse that there's no point even going in a break. No, or, you know, one rider might go down the road and everyone else just sort of almost gives themselves a rest day. But it's very, very rare now. Generally speaking, it is that sort of whittling down when, you know, you had very established World Tour pros today quitting after 100 kilometres. And the consensus being, and their reaction, sometimes we saw the interview, being that they'd done a really good job. And that was all that was expected of them. Their race was 100 kilometres, 120 kilometres. And that's because, you know, those first 120 kilometres are extremely difficult. Lionel, an exceptional ride by Ben Healy in an exceptional season. I can't say I was surprised because, again, we talked about the likeness with Amstel Gold and we've seen him perform well and attritional race. I thought he would go well. Again, not a particularly tactical race. I thought he would go well and he did.
Yeah, he was one of the riders that I named in our sort of scattergun look at, you know, who beyond Pogacar and Remco Evenepoel we might be watching out for today. And it was calmly done as well, wasn't it? He probably realised he was racing for silver at best from the moment that he stuck his nose in the wind. But there was a horrible kind of moment for those three riders. You know, it was a long moment, wasn't it? Knowing that, you know, three into two wouldn't go and that somebody was riding as hard as possible and would end up without a medal. And that's one of the other aspects of a World Championship road race that we kind of sometimes overlook. But in this case, you know, that full commitment of the five, and then when it broke down to three, it could have kind of, you know, it could have all kind of gone back together again. But Healy and Skelmoser as well, although it didn't work out for him, he was equally as committed, but he was the one who faded first. But yeah, a fantastic ride by Ben Healy, and what a season for him. I mean, stage win at Tour de France, yellow jersey at the Tour de France, and now a bronze medal at the Worlds.
Lionel, rather than sort of linger on any further sort of disappointing performances, I didn't really see too many that you would say were obvious kind of flops of the day. You know, we had riders like Carapaz who looked good at one stage and then faded and eventually abandoned the race, and Egan Bernal also abandoned. Aaronsman I thought would go well, but he abandoned. We may well get explanations for these later on. Riders being ill, not feeling good today. But Lionel, just in closing, I did want to mention something that I wasted everyone's time with a few days ago. Our friend from Nauru, or not from Nauru, Valerio Alessandri, who no sooner had we recorded a few days ago than he was removed from the provisional start list. And this was a mystery, it was an intriguing mystery. And as I had, as I said in the podcast the other day, I'd sort of released my detective hounds in Kigali, given various people sort of brief the mission, the imperative to go and investigate this. They made some headway, not too much. One Italian journalist, Ettore Giovanelli, tracked him down, apparently, and he was in Kigali, importantly. So this gentleman, he was born in Switzerland, we established that, Locarno, Italian-speaking Switzerland. He was supposed to be riding for Nauru. We talked about it being the third smallest country in the world, island in the South Pacific, but then he disappeared from the start list. What did Ettore and others find out for me? Well, he was in Kigali. He was removed from the start list for what I was told were bureaucratic and political reasons. I mean, the mind boggles. But these were the very bare details that I was fed. But today, Lionel, instead of riding for Nauru, he made himself useful by acting as a sort of mechanic and soigneur for Sao Tome and Principe. They had, was it one or two riders in the field? But again, this feels as though, like, this was just sort of I was fed this information just kind of off the cuff, matter-of-factly, as though it didn't merit or require any further interrogation. But it feels as though this could be this is sort of fertile material for several Netflix miniseries.
I thought, Daniel, you were going to drop the bombshell that he was working as a mechanic for the Belgium team today.
Yes.
Which might have explained Remco's difficulties with his saddle, but no.
Yeah, but I'll endeavour to investigate, to continue my inquiries, investigate further over the next few days, and maybe give the definitive version of what on who is Valerio Alessandri and what he was doing in Kigali exactly in a forthcoming episode. Lionel, anything else to mention?
Well, final word really on Pogacar winning back-to-back world titles. Joins a list of riders who have won two in a row. Julian Alaphilippe, the most recent. Paolo Bettini and Gianni Bugno of Italy. Rick Van Looy and Rick Van Steenbergen of Belgium in the 50s and 60s, and Ronsa in the late 1920s as well, another Belgian rider. Can he next year equal the record, Peter Sagan's three in a row from 2015 to 2017? Well, the Worlds will be in Montreal in Canada next year. At Montreal, one of the scenes of one of the most attritional men's road races in the World Championships of all time in 1974, where there were only 18 finishes on that occasion. So, we could get a three-peat next year for Pogacar, but that is, you know, speculation of events that are happening in a year's time. I mean, that's beyond the pale, isn't it?
Same finishing circuit as for the GP Montreal, which he has won on a couple of occasions. So don't be shocked if he does get the hat trick in a year's time. Lionel, we'll be back later in the week, won't we?
We will indeed.
Yes. Hopefully, maybe. I've already sort of teased it without consulting the gentleman himself, but maybe with some input from Larry, who will tell us how it all went in Rwanda for him and the American team. Until then, Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel. Now for another couple of sporting non-contests. We've got Arsenal against Newcastle and then the Ryder Cup.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.